You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, October 12th, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. I am on the road, folks, for one more day. We'll be back live tomorrow. But today I've got a great interview for you with Randall Kennedy. He has written the book, The Persistence of the Color Line, about President Obama's election to the presidency of the United States and dealing with the issues of race. It's a fascinating conversation. I spoke to him for nearly 30 minutes, and I know you're going to enjoy this. And for members, stick around. I've got an interview with Eric Alterman, the great writer from The Nation, author of many, many books, too many for me to say. Coming up afterwards for you on the stupidity of the media. Folks, I need your support. I need you to become a Majority Report member at majority.fm. You can also support the show by buying your crap through our Amazon link and bookmarking that link. Always buy your crap through there. If you're buying it from Amazon, we get a kickback. And also, you can buy some coffee at a great fair trade coffee place out of Madison, Wisconsin. JustCoffee.coop, coffee, tea, chocolate, all fair trade. It's a co-op owned by the people who work there. Get a 10% discount with the coupon code MAJORITY. Enjoy today's show and enjoy, for you members, enjoy, stick around because I've got an interview with Eric Alterman. I will be back tomorrow live from a mass torts convention, yes, in Las Vegas. Cliff Schechter and more will be joining me there. Folks, until then. Enjoy. Professor, thanks so much for joining us.
Sure. Thank you for having me on.
Really appreciate the opportunity to talk to you. Okay. So, Professor, let's start. I mean, your book is fascinating. Both you relate certain personal stories of your father, but the book really focuses on President Obama and how he got elected and is president in the context of race in this country. And one of the things that sort of, I guess, it's almost a shame that I asked this question, but it is sort of the reality of American politics. How is it that as a black man in America, he managed to get elected based upon our history of electing black men and women to federal positions?
Well, it was unprecedented, of course, and that's why so much attention has been visited on the election and governance of Barack Obama. In the history of the United States, there have been only two popularly elected governors, only three popularly elected United States senators. So that's, it was a quite extraordinary thing when Barack Obama won the White House in 2008. How did he win it? Well, and what does it symbolize? It certainly symbolizes a dramatic change in racial attitudes. I mean, in the late 1950s, pollsters asked white Americans whether they would be willing under any circumstances to vote for a black person who would represent their own party. And in the late 1950s, three-fifths of white Americans said no, under no circumstances would they vote for a black person, even if that person was the nominee of their own party. By the 1990s, that had dropped, you know, quite dramatically, to like 1 in 10. So, you know, racial attitudes have changed, and that made it possible. Barack Obama could have walked on water a half century ago, and he wouldn't have been elected president of the United States, but, you know, but racial attitudes have changed. That does not mean that racism and that racial discrimination is gone, hence the title of my book, The Persistence of the Color Line. Barack Obama was helped in certain ways by his race, but he was also hurt in certain ways by his race. So, you know, the color line still remains with us.
There's two facets to this that I find fascinating. One is what he had to do to win black support early on, which wasn't there at the beginning of his campaign. And the other is that disparity between the fact that racism still exists in this country and it probably has not changed in many respects from before he was elected. But what is it that what is that needle he had to thread, let's say, for white voters that needle he had to thread that fit in between the sort of unlikelihood, perhaps, that based on our history, that he would be elected and that racism that persists?
Well, he had to allay the anxiety of white voters and non-black voters in general. I mean, he had to do what John F. Kennedy had to do back in 1960 when John F. Kennedy was running for the presidency. He was a Catholic, and he had to assuage the anxieties of non-Catholics. Well, Barack Obama in 2008 had to assuage the anxieties of non-blacks. He had to essentially say, listen, you know, I'm not angry, I'm not resentful, I do not bear the traits that have been associated negatively with you know, black stereotypes. He had to say all of that over and over and over again in a lot of different ways to whites, and he succeeded. Not entirely. You know, it should be remembered that Barack Obama did not win the majority of white voters in 2008. If it had only been the white electorate, John McCain would be president of the United States. But he won enough white voters to prevail.
And for black folk, he had to also overcome, I guess, the notion that that I guess the ingrained belief in black folk that a black man in the year 2008 could not be elected president.
Yeah, he had to do a variety of things. He had to, on the one hand, he had to assuage, you know, black people's anxieties. I remember during the campaign when he was vying for the nomination with against Hillary Clinton in South Carolina, there were black people who told, you know, journalists, you know, we're with Obama, but we fear for him. We're not going to vote for him because we think that if he's the nominee, he'll be killed.
Right.
So, I mean, he had to, Obama had to, in a sense, confront deeply ingrained feelings of futility and fear within black Americans. He also had to overcome the notion voiced by some that he wasn't, quote, black enough. I mean, after all, his mother was white. His grandparents who helped raise him were white. He was not socialized in a typically black environment. So there were some black people who wondered where his loyalties lay. And so he had to win over black people. He had to show black people, or at least many black people, that he knew black history, that he was grateful for the struggles that had been undertaken within black communities to elevate African Americans. He had to do that. So he had to assuage the anxieties not only of white people but black people too.
Right. I mean, in some respects, it may be the same challenge that someone like Mitt Romney has with conservatives. One presents themselves from a certain culture, and there may be reason to question, or you want some validation, I guess. Although
that's right. I mean, you know, Mitt Romney being a Mormon.
Right.
He's going to have to assuage the anxieties of people who don't know and are somewhat nervous. There's a certain way in which, you know, any pioneer, anybody who's going to be a first, whether it's a woman, whether it's, whether it's religion, whether it's gender, whether it's sexual orientation, what have you, there is going to be this heightened anxiety, and if you're a pioneer, you've got to face that and somehow assuage those anxieties.
All right, we've got to take a break, and when we come back, I want to talk about how that dynamic of assuaging and almost sort of having to play against a stereotype that exists somewhere in the American mind, at least, has affected President Obama's ability to be president. We've got to take a break. We'll be right back. So, Professor, we talked about what President Obama, what candidate Barack Obama had to do in terms, within the context of a racial context. Obviously, there was a lot more that he had to do to become, to win an election, particularly, just getting through a primary with a candidate that many people thought would be a fait accompli. How has that impacted his being president? Because, I mean, we're at a time now where there is an erosion of his base. Democrats in general, not necessarily more than in past Democratic presidents, but at a rate that is increasing. We're seeing the activist base complaining. We're seeing progressive black voices out there criticizing the president. How has his race impacted the way he's been president in that context?
Yeah, it's affected him a considerable amount. Number one, I want to accentuate something that you said, and that is, of course, we're talking about race in the Obama presidency, but of course, there's a lot more involved in that than that. It's not just race. There's ideology, partisanship, all sorts of things are going on. So I do not want to be heard to be making any claim that, you know, race is the only thing, or in some instances it's not even the most important thing. But it is of significance, and it has been significant in the way in which Obama governs. One thing is Obama doesn't like to talk about race. I mean, he is sometimes forced to talk about it, but by and large he understands that race talk for him is not good. It's not good for him electorally. And so he doesn't want to talk about race. He doesn't want to frame public policies in a racial frame. Now, that, of course, presents a dilemma for him, because there are some people in his base who are impatient with that. So, you know, there's some people recently, I think of Representative Maxine Waters, who says, listen, you know, black people are being disproportionately hurt by the economic downturn. We want you to do something specific for black people, the black unemployed and underemployed. Well, you know, Obama resists that. And he does because, of course, if he does that, then there will be detractors who will accuse him of racial favoritism. You know, he's a black man. They'll accuse him of, in a sense, being, you know, showing favoritism to black people.
But can I, Professor, stop you here for a moment? Because I think that there's obviously a couple of things at play here. There's one thing about talking about race, because then that plays into a sort of quasi-racist notion that that's the way that he defines himself exclusively. And then there's the other issue of not wanting to be seen as playing favorites. But when you have a situation where, and I'm not sure that Maxine Waters or Cornel West or others are asking for special policies directed specifically for black people, but we do have a massive unemployment problem in the country, and we do have a massive economic pain that's going on, and black people are suffering from that disproportionately.
Yes.
And so I think I don't want to characterize what they're saying, but one would think that there is an urgency there from the black community that would even supersede the already what I would consider emergency situation we have.
Yes, and I'm not, by the way, I'm not saying that Maxine Waters' argument is wrong in principle. You know, when Richard Nixon became president in 1968, his Secretary of Labor designate, George Shultz, a conservative Republican, when he was asked what's the major economic problem confronting the United States, he said it was black teenage unemployment. Mm. And we need to do something special about that. So there's nothing, you know, there's nothing, and there was nothing wrong with Shultz saying that. There would be nothing wrong in principle with Obama saying it. The problem is if he was to say it, his detractors would make hay out of it because of racial anxieties right. in the United States. And so he, being an electoral politician, has to be keenly attentive to public opinion, and he does not want to give his detractors ammunition that, you know, might resonate with the public and lead to his disempowerment. That's all I was saying.
Right. Okay. I mean, because at the same time, too, from a political standpoint, he seems to. I mean, I guess the sort of the complaint coming from many in the progressive community is that he seems to not be attentive to the economic plight of people, or to the extent that he has, he's made that shift. Frankly, in the past, it seems almost 2 or 3 weeks. That he has become more rhetorically attentive to that.
He's been more rhetorically attentive, but I think he's been more rhetorically attentive. I mean, frankly, Barack Obama is a smart person who is keenly attentive to what's going on in the United States. He certainly has known about the disproportionate burden put on black people by the economic downturn. The question is, how can he most effectively deal with that? Now, you know, again, he has a dilemma. If he deals with it in a certain way, then there are going to be a lot of Americans, non-blacks, who are going to look at him askance. On the other hand, if he does not say certain things, there are going to be members in his black base who are going to be impatient with him. That is a dilemma that he faces. Now, you know, because of Maxine Waters and others, he has, yes, been more rhetorically attentive in the last couple of weeks. But frankly, I think that's a matter of rhetoric.
Right.
I don't think that his policy has changed. He simply had to adjust. Because one thing that's very important, he has to, while he has to be attentive to, you know, the white public, he has to be attentive to the black public, too. I mean, the, you know, black Americans are they're the anchor of the pro-Obama coalition.
Right.
And even though it's the case that most black people are with him, if he faces even a marginal diminution in enthusiasm among blacks, that's going to cause him problems in the next election.
I guess, you know, one of the biggest questions from the progressive perspective is that, are we talking about political efficacy? Because I don't necessarily see a political price for President Obama from a policy standpoint or a rhetorical standpoint to be talking about issues in a general term that happen to be more of an emergency or an urgency within the black community. I don't necessarily see the political or policy-oriented disadvantage to that. There's some who question as to whether or not, in fact, he is maybe just not inclined to have a more progressive perspective, you know, at all. I mean,
no, I think that's erroneous. I mean, Barack Obama, as a senator, had the most liberal voting record in the Senate. I think that in impulse, he is progressive, but he is a cautious professional politician who is keenly attentive to public opinion. I think that he will go as far over in a progressive direction as he thinks that he can without incurring political electoral risk. If things move over more to the left, he'll drift over more to the left. If things, on the other hand, are pushed more to the right, as has happened in the past couple of years, he'll go more to the right.
Well, but, you know, I know the study you're talking about, he was the most liberal senator, and John Kerry was considered the most liberal senator before that by the same outfit that rated him in 2004. But it is the case that, for instance, entering into his administration, the people he chose to surround himself with were very much of the same neoliberal core that the Clinton administration
true.
Had.
That's true.
And it was the case that as early as the inauguration, they were talking about a grand bargain, about, you know, perhaps trading away things like Social Security, the way that, you know, cuts in Social Security, cuts in Medicare. And by any definition, this is not a progressive agenda. I mean, Social Security keeps more than 60% of our elderly out of poverty. So is it really simply a matter of rhetoric? I mean, I do see the areas where he can be pushed in a liberal perspective, but not necessarily when it comes to economics.
I think that if the boundary post to the left was moved over, you would find Barack Obama going over there. You know, listen, I'm to the left of Barack Obama by a considerable margin. In my book, I am critical of Barack Obama on a variety of fronts where I think that he has actually been, he's not pushed over as far as he could have gone without incurring political risk. So I think he has left money on the table. I think that he has been overly cautious. But in basic tendency, I think that he is a person whose, you know, whose impulse is liberal. The problem is he, you know, he feels that he is constrained. I think that he feels more constrained than he actually is, but he feels really constrained. And I think that if progressives could push things over, they would find him more of an ally.
I wonder, I mean, from your perspective, and this may be more of a psychological than a sociological question, but what extent do you think that race as experienced by him and race as a question within the context of American society create that perception of constraint?
Oh, I think you've hit a very good point. I think that that's very important. I mean, after all, let's get back to, you know, the most singular thing that Barack Obama ever did as a politician. What's the most singular thing that he ever did? The most singular thing that he ever did was to imagine that he, a black man, could be president of the United States. Now, you know, why did he take that step? Why did he... what was so singular about that? Well, one thing that was singular about it was that previous politicians had thought, black politicians, had thought that that was just off the table. I think that, you know, there are many black politicians, actually, who have, because of our terrible history of racism, have actually exaggerated the constraints upon them.
Mm-hmm.
You know? I think that they have actually sometimes felt more boxed in than social realities actually had them. I think that, in fact, in other words, there was more room than they had actually perceived. And do I think that that's part of what's going on with Barack Obama? Yes. So, for instance, you know, could he actually do things more to push policies in a more progressive direction with respect to race and sexual orientation and other things? I think he could, but I think that he is so concerned about, you know, reaction and reactionary sentiments and, frankly, anti-black sentiments in America that it, you know, it's caused him to be extra cautious.
Right. Well, I mean, I would imagine growing up with that, there is a sense of you get one, you don't get three strikes. You get no strikes.
And, that's right. And you feel like you've got to be perfect.
And
tie, you lose. That's what my father always told me. Right. And I think that that is operative with Obama. You know, certainly with respect to racial stuff. I mean, he really distances himself, and I think that he distances himself so, you know, with so studiously, because, you know, he has this awareness of our racial history. It's completely understandable. I think he overdoes it sometimes, but it's completely understandable.
And frankly, I don't know that it's it doesn't parallel the same dynamic that we see in the media from associating themselves with any disenfranchised in the country. I think that's a problem with the establishment on some level.
Yeah. And remember, again, so here's this guy who is seeking to exercise presidential power, and he's confronting an array of forces. And one thing that he's confronting, again, getting back to the subject of my book, is this amorphous but powerful thing in American life, the race line. And that's something that, you know, no other person occupying the White House has had to confront in the same way. And, you know, that's unprecedented. And it's for that reason that, though I'm critical of Obama in various ways, I think that all critics of him, particularly critics from the left, have to be attentive to the peculiar dilemmas that this man faces.
It's fascinating stuff, and the book is equally fascinating. Professor, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me on.